Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
A very good morning to you this Wednesday, the 28th of September. Welcome to Africa Link. I'm Jane Ayeko Kumet in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, the International Criminal Court sentences a Malian jihadist Ahmed Al-Faki Al-Mahdi to 9 years for his part in destroying the shrines in Timbuktu.
The chamber unanimously sentences you to 9 years of imprisonment.
Sierra Leone's Minister for Agriculture, Monty Jones, speaks to Africa Link about their plans to prevent future outbreaks of Ebola and revival of the agricultural sector.
Anything that we can do, to stop this disease, for coming up again to attack people, Sierra Leone will do that. And that is the value that I see in this project that we're putting together.
Stay tuned to this edition of Africa Link.
Top story.
The International Criminal Court in The Hague has sent a radical Muslim, Ahmed Al-Faki Al-Mahdi, to prison for 9 years after finding him guilty of overseeing the destruction of historic Muslims in the Malian desert city of Timbuktu in 2012. During the first hearing, Al-Mahdi pleaded guilty, saying he was indeed sorry for his actions and asked for forgiveness. This was the first case in which the ICC treated the destruction of world heritage as a war crime. But in Timbuktu itself, Deputy Mayor Drau Aseku Maiga was disappointed with the verdict.
For the residents of Timbuktu and the whole population of Mali, the verdict isn't enough. Malians know the importance of Timbuktu as an ancient historical city. The defendant has asked for forgiveness, but that doesn't mean one should forget the horror of what he did.
Our correspondent Catherine Martins was in court at the ICC when the verdict and the sentence were read out. Mark Caldwell asked her what the defendant's reaction had been.
Well, I would say the sentence was not a surprise for him, given that in the very beginning already, when the trial started, he already pleaded fully, really guilty. So he was fully cooperating with the prosecution and the court itself. So I would say he was very aware that there will be a sentence against him. And it was just a question if it would be a really high sentence, a really strong one. Full would have been 30 years. But I think all in all, he was quite aware what would happen today.
So was 9 years then what court observers were expecting?
I think we can really say that 9 years are definitely in the line regarding international expectations, given that there was really a guilty plea in the very beginning, a spontaneous one from the side of the defendant. It was very clear, even it was made clear by the prosecution, that there won't be a full 30-year sentence. I think this is what everybody was expecting indeed.
It must be very difficult to work out what a just sentence would be for the destruction of world heritage. Did the judges give any inkling as to how they arrived at 9 years?
Yes, it was actually a very long description. They put forward that a key element for them was, first of all, of course, that there was a full admission of guilt. And furthermore, they stressed that he was regretting his act. And they said it is the very first time that they observed that on site he had a certain reluctance to commit this act. And all in all, this made the judges, the chamber, consider that 9 years could be an appropriate sentence for him in this trial.
How important is this case for the ICC's reputation?
So indeed, this is a very important case because the reputation was a lot criticized. First of all, because of the time normally a case is taking. So a case normally we are talking about easy 5, 6, 7 years, and this case was finished about 2 months all in all around. And this is the first good thing for the reputation for the ICC. And of course, it is really seen as a landmark trial at a time when attacks on cultural heritage have gained prevalence and attention, not only in Africa, but in Syria as well, for example. So it is a good day for the reputation for the International Criminal Court, actually.
Did you get the impression that the court considered this case less serious than previous ones because it did not specifically deal with the loss of human life?
My personal feeling is that they took it really serious. It was just very strange to see that the very first time it didn't take years to get to a conclusion, to get to a verdict. I think given that they themselves, they wanted to set a precedent, it was really important to them to gather really all evidence and to make a proper case of it. So I don't think they took it less serious. It was just a less strong sentence because in the very end, there was no person really harmed.
Katrin Martins at the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Now, the Nigerian government is planning to borrow $5 billion from abroad to finance capital infrastructure projects in a bid to boost the country's ailing economy. Part of the loan will come from the African Development Bank, whose president, Akinwumi Adesina, concludes a three-day visit to Nigeria today. James Shikwati is an economist and founder director of the Inter-Region Economic Network in Kenya. He has been speaking to Mark Caldwell about the difficulty Nigeria is finding to raise loans for infrastructure projects.
First of all, the background of the Nigerian economy has been that they were over-reliant on the export of raw materials, which made it a bit unattractive in terms of its value promise to a potential financier. So I think by Akinwumi Adesina is actually a former minister in a Nigerian government, so he must be knowing the challenge of just having a one-sided approach to having a rich economy. And probably as an African Development Bank initiative, I think he might also carry along a message of diversification for the Nigerian economy if it has to really sustain its vibrancy as a leading economy in sub-Sahara.
How important is the African connection here? Is the AFDB an obvious choice for Nigeria as it casts around for loans?
Well, I think I would say the most current obvious choice that is fashionable is always to go to China. And I think already the Nigerian president a few months ago visited already China to get some pledges towards infrastructure development. And so I think the African Development Bank would be, I think, adding an additional maybe financier. But I think Nigerian eyes are looking at the big bucks that come from the Chinese side.
Nigeria went into recession last month. Its currency is falling, inflation is in double digits, and the country is suffering from a lack of foreign exchange. It's also suffering from low oil prices. How would you describe the Nigerian government's attempts to find a way out of this crisis or crises?
I think the Nigerian government can consider itself lucky that it has a population that literally runs on autopilot, the very vibrant, entrepreneurial, individual Nigerians that you'll find all over the world doing lots of activities that really have helped put Nigeria on the map. So I think that in itself should be able to energize now the government side to see that they have a role to stabilize their economy, because as far as the Nigerian entrepreneurs are concerned, they're not waiting for the Nigerian government. And you notice that one of the wealthiest person in Africa is actually from Nigeria, Aliko Dangote. So that tells you that in terms of the individual enterprise spirit, Nigeria is really still on top of the sub-Saharan map, despite the challenges it's facing now.
How important are these capital infrastructure projects, and when will they start to have an impact?
Well, for the capital infrastructure project, one of the key outcomes that we could say from an African point of view is how it's helping individual nation-state economies to connect with the regional economies. So, for instance, now for Nigeria, having better infrastructure would mean that it can also take its goods to neighboring countries. At the same time, of course, take goods to export markets in Europe or maybe in Asia. But in terms of when one can yield returns, I think somebody should put 15 years, I'm looking at a generation, because you have also to populate the country with the people with the necessary skills and capability to be able to then utilize that infrastructure to deliver the economic promise that the country really requires.
James Shikwati, founder and director of the Interregion Economic Network.
News, analysis, and feature reports. All that here on Africa Link.
Now to Kenya, which on Tuesday became the first country in the world to launch child-friendly medicines for treating tuberculosis in accordance to the World Health Organization's guidelines. The new drugs come in the correct doses for children, are fruit-flavored and dissolve in water, making them easy for children to take. According to the country's Ministry of Health, 85% of the new TB cases are reported in children. Children under the age of 5 have the greatest risk of severe infection and death from TB. Last year alone, 7,000 cases of the disease were recorded in Kenya, from where Andrew Wasike reports.
12-year-old Brian Mutiga from Thorntree School in Ongatarongai, close to the capital Nairobi, wants to become a neurosurgeon when he grows up. I met up with him during the launch of the new child-friendly medicines for treating tuberculosis by the Ministry of Health in Kenya. It marks the East African country's first program to distribute the improved child-friendly formulations of TB drugs nationally. Mutiga, who also had TB, tells me that most children skip their doses as the medicine tastes really bad, as he put it.
Most children have died of TB. The launch of the new medicine, I think it's nice, it's friendly, and that most percentage of the children will be relieved of the TB.
Globally, TB is the leading infectious killer, with 1.5 million people dying of the disease each year. Children, being the most vulnerable, and around 1 million are infected with TB annually. 140,000 of them die from the preventable and curable disease each year. Tuberculosis in Kenya is usually underdiagnosed and sometimes confused with other pediatric illnesses, leading to the deaths of many children under the age of 5. Kenya's Ministry of Health estimates that in 2015 alone, 7,000 children contracted the illness. Director of the Medical Services at the Ministry of Health, Dr. Jackson Kioko, told the opening conference that the launch of the TB medicine for children is a major stride in the health sector for Kenya as a country.
We've not been able to put as many children or even to trace as many children out there who have TB in the past and initiate them on treatment. This has been an uphill task.
He added that many of the possible 10% of Kenyan children who need to be on TB medication do not receive the necessary treatment. Dr. Kioko says that this is not good enough.
But now, I think as a country we are proudly to say that there is now a new formulation which is friendly to our children. And now it is available in all our 9,000 outlets in this country.
The improved TB medicines are fruit-flavored and also easier for caregivers to give and for children to take. They are also expected to help improve the treatment of TB and the rate of child survival. Dr. Cherise Scott from the TB Alliance, an international non-profit organization which was involved in the development of the drugs, says that there are concrete differences between the old way of TB treatment in children and the new one.
The old way people are treating were to cut and mix and to crush adult medications or medications that were not appropriately dosed. But now we have, not only do we have the right dosage for children, we have a pill that's easily dissolvable in water in seconds, and then it tastes in a way that is easier to take for children, so there's flavoring.
The treatment, now introduced in Kenya, is the first to meet the WHO's guidelines for childhood TB treatment. Two of Kenya's neighbors, Uganda and Tanzania, are also preparing to roll out the correctly dosed childhood TB medicines, and 20 more countries are expected to join by the end of the year.
Andrew Wasike in Nairobi. Now we take a quick break. When we come back, we shall hear how Sierra Leone is moving forward after battling the Ebola epidemic. Keep around.
Behind the headlines.
You're still listening to Africa Link, coming to you live from our studios in Bonn, Germany, with me, Jane Ayeko Kumet. The Ebola epidemic in West Africa, which began in 2013, killed more than 11,300 people as it swept through Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea. Early this year, the World Health Organization declared those three countries free of the disease, but a few who experienced it firsthand are unlikely to forget the epidemic. Monty Jones is Sierra Leone's Minister for Agriculture, Forestry and Food Security, and he's here in Germany to discuss a new initiative to try and prevent future outbreaks of the deadly virus. My colleague Mark Caldwell spoke to him, and he started by asking him what the new initiative entailed.
Anything that we can do, you know, to stop this disease, Sierra Leone will do that. And that is the value that I see in this project that we're putting together, trying to identify the source of Ebola infection on human beings, whether from domestic or wild animals. And we hope if we are able to trace the sources, we'll be able to put a stop to this, because the pains that we've gone through, you know, we wouldn't want any country to go through that kind of suffering.
Agriculture accounts for just over half of Sierra Leone's GDP. During the Ebola crisis, crops went unharvested because of the measures that were put in place to contain the disease. Has the agriculture sector now fully recovered?
Today, I would say that agriculture has recovered. The reason for that is, I believe, government was able to move fast, you know, to get quality inputs to farmers. Because if you are not able to plant your field in 2014 or 2015, because for one reason or the other, then what you probably may have missed is pure seeds, you know. And so the government was quick to get seeds and distribute those seeds to farmers. They were quick to get fertilizers and distribute to the farmers, quick to get other chemicals and machinery, you know, for use by the farmers. So yes, by 2016, I think the farmers have recovered completely from the Ebola problems. And I've been traveling the length and breadth of the country, looking at production areas and noticing new people. And we reckon that the minimum could be 10% increase. The maximum could be probably around 30 or slightly over 30% increase in the area under cultivation. But that is not all. We are also expecting maybe a 10% increase in yield, you know, because of the inputs that we're giving to the farmers. So we expect to recover completely from the Ebola by 2016.
One complaint leveled against agribusiness in Africa is that of land grabbing, in which local farmers find that their land has been taken away from them following deals with foreign companies and government officials. How much tension is there between local residents and agribusiness in Sierra Leone?
Well, I think this is an issue that occurs every now and then in some countries in Africa. Sierra Leone, for example, it hasn't been a serious issue until very recently, when we've seen some tension between the landowners and the private sector. But government has always tried to intervene one way or the other, and the tension seems to have slowed down. So I don't actually see that as a major issue right now in Sierra Leone, but it is a sensitive one that the government is very keen and very particular, you know, to intervene whenever such problems occur. But to solve that kind of problem once and for all, we're looking at the land tenure system in Sierra Leone. We're coming up with a new policy for land use in Sierra Leone that we believe will reduce that kind of tension.
Monty Jones, Sierra Leone's Minister for Agriculture, Forestry and Food Security. Recent student protests in South Africa demonstrate that higher education remains a volatile issue in the continent. Education broadens horizons, but the frustration can be great if the expectation it raises can't be met. The brain drain that is afflicting Africa also doesn't help, and the continent's research effort is suffering. From Uganda, Alex Jutta reports on Partnership for Africa's Next Generation of Academics, in short Pangea, a program at Makerere University designed to rejuvenate African university research and university management.
The program is designed to train more African researchers as a tool to improve the quality of education on the continent. In Uganda, like many African countries, research departments are not well funded, nor are they viewed as a priority. Professor Edward Kiromira is the head of the Partnership for Africa's Next Generation of Academics, Pangea for short. Kiromira says that many universities in Africa are headed by retiring administrators and hopes the Pangea program will produce young professors to replace them.
A number of universities face a challenge that you find departments that are almost closing because the professors there are retired or about to retire. And there are no new young people coming up. So the partnership provides a network that they can use to come up with huge research projects, but also within that framework, mentors them to become the next academic administrators.
Pangea is a network of leading African universities developing research capacity to stimulate the expertise to build and sustain world-class doctoral programs on and about the African continent. Joining Uganda are universities from Tanzania, Kenya, Cameroon, Botswana, Senegal, and South Africa. Pangea also identified many more problems facing the education sector across Africa, and on top of the list are people who leave the continent to find work elsewhere. Kirumira says that this program intends to stop this practice.
Pangea is emphasizing training on the continent so that the students train within the environment with which they are going to operate in. When we train our staff from here, then we can build the capacity of the training environment.
The project is fully funded by international bodies. Michael Hansler of the Gerda Henkel Stiftung, one of the funders of Pangea, says that the program has been designed to address the needs of individual universities.
It will focus on the development of research and management capacity through broad-based research and scholarship support on each of the Pangea partner campuses throughout Africa.
Bruce Kabagambe, a researcher at the Makerere Institute of Social Research, or MISR, says that on top of the funding from abroad, the government of Uganda should seriously consider locally funding programs that improve the workforce.
Makerere University and the government of Uganda should take MISR to be an entity that will contribute in accelerating Uganda's growth to a middle-income country. And as such, both the university and the government need to put in local resources so that MISR produces for the better, because human capital development is a critical factor in the development of Uganda as a country.
The high levels of unemployment in countries like Uganda have been blamed on a poor education system. Programs like Pangea will hopefully, in the long run, contribute to the reduction of unemployed but educated youths by offering them a better option than leaving the country to pursue their research.
Alex Gita in Kampala.
Opinion.
To our top story first, at the International Criminal Court in The Hague, Malian jihadist Ahmad Al-Faqi Al-Mahdi has been sent to prison for 9 years for his part in the destruction of shrines in Timbuktu. Do you think the sentence was too lenient, too severe, or just right? We've also been hearing about efforts to rejuvenate research at African universities. What do you think would be the best way to reverse the brain drain? Let us know your opinion on either or both of those stories by sending us an email to feedback.africa@dw.com or an SMS to country code 49160957 59510 or a letter to AfricaLink DW53110 Bonn, Germany. And now, before I leave you, here is a reminder of some of our top stories. At the International Crime Court in The Hague, a Malian jihadist has been jailed for 9 years for his part in destroying shrines in Timbuktu. Kenya is rolling out child-friendly medicines for the treatment of tuberculosis. And Sierra Leone's Minister for Agriculture is in Germany to discuss a new initiative to prevent future outbreaks of Ebola. That's it for today. From me, Jane Ayeko Kumat, life is sweet, so look at it from the positive side. Goodbye.